Voice Alliance International Podcast.
I don't make this stuff up.
You know, if you put Jesus Christ first, that he'll look after all your bills.
It's not fake. It's faith.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Atheist Alliance International Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Sylvester. Just before we get started, I'd like to remind everybody to please like and subscribe. We've been off for a few weeks. Well, I've been on vacation, and several of our upcoming guests have also been on summer vacation, so we're back now. And this week, we are joined by Professor Dr. Susan Blackmore, who is a psychologist, a skeptic, an atheist, a humanist, a prolific author, and she's here to talk about her work. So good morning, or good afternoon for you, Dr. Blackmore.
Yeah, it's afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah. All right, so maybe you could start off a little bit by just telling our watchers a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Oh, well, what I do is a right mishmash of things. I mean, I should sort of retire and do all the gardening, and I meditate a lot every day, and I'm training in Zen, which is great. But against that, I do too much work, write too much, have too much email, and get drowned by things. But I suppose my two real interests at the moment are memetics and whether the theory of memes can really help us understand, in particular, understand religions. Because it seems to me that the major religions are... they're memeplexes that are fighting to use our brains to pass themselves on. And they are very, very sticky memes, and they do us a lot of harm. So that's one thing that I'm working on and trying to write a book about, but we'll see whether that comes off or not. And the other thing is the problems of consciousness, because what a fantastic mystery this is. You know, we're learning, the more we learn about how the brain works, like we know where the visual processing is working. There are even ways of telling what somebody is thinking about or what they're looking at or what music they're listening to, which is really weird. But the more we learn about the brain, the less we can explain why there's this experience, why it's like this. And the nature of self is all part of that, because it seems to be that I'm in here and there's a world out there and I'm conscious of the physical world and all these philosophical problems. So I spend a lot of time thinking about that. Those, I guess, are the main things that I'm doing at the moment.
Okay. And you're also a professor of psychology, correct?
Well, I'm a visiting professor at the University of Plymouth. Here in the UK, which it doesn't pay. I mean, I haven't had a paid job most of my life. People think that I'm a proper serious academic. I've actually only had a proper academic job for 10 years of my life, and a lot of that was part-time. It's a weird thing to say, but it doesn't suit me having a job. When I was doing that job, I loved the teaching and the students, but all the other stuff just got me down so much. I felt that I was being paid to not work. And my ideal life, which I happily have here, living in the beautiful countryside in South Devon, is get up, have my breakfast, go to my desk and work and write and think and read and not have to go somewhere else and go to meetings and fill in forms and stuff like that. So that I'm very solitary, apart from when I go to conferences or something like that. I like to work entirely on my own, and that's what I've done mostly. So... the professor thing is a genuine connection with the local university here, which is great, but it's not a job and I don't get paid anything.
Right. Okay. But you still have a background in psychology that goes along with your study of consciousness and memetics and looking.
Oh,
at,
yes.
At
the oh, yes. I did my first degree in physiology and psychology at Oxford back in 1970. And that's when I had... it was in my first term at Oxford that I had the most extraordinary mystical experience, beginning as an out-of-the-body experience and transforming into ultimately to oneness with the universe and so on. And that led me down an enormous red herring loop because I thought this proved, you know, there are worlds beyond and consciousness beyond the brain and life after death. I was completely convinced there was life after death because my soul had left my body. And it was, I did my PhD investigating those kinds of things and not finding any evidence that it was true. And I think this was quite important in bolstering my leaving behind my Church of England and Methodist upbringing that I'd had. Because doing experimental work and asking for evidence is so much the opposite of what a religion does, saying, you know, here's this book, believe this, or else. And that experience of spending, well, it was probably most of the 70s until I finally became very definitely skeptical about all those paranormal claims. So I did my PhD on that. So yeah, that I have a proper background in physiology and psychology, and it's a good combination. I'm sorry, I never did philosophy at university, but you can't do everything. And people often think I'm a philosopher, but I'm not trained in philosophy. And I always feel kind of nervous about stepping into difficult philosophical problems because I don't have that background. But all my thinking is those three subjects. And now that neuroscience is doing so brilliantly, the fact that I do have some training in physiology and neuroanatomy and all those kind of related topics is quite helpful.
Okay. Have you done any reading on the new field of neurotheology, where they're doing the brain scans of people having religious experiences?
Yes, yes. I got involved in a creepy book called Neurotheology must probably be 10 years ago now, and I don't even remember the name of the guy, but I was fooled because
Andrew Newberg?
Pardon? No. He's done proper research. No, this was some weird guy, and it was published by the University of California Press or the press of the, you know, something that doesn't exist, but I was sucked into it. That was my first encounter with neurotheology. But I mean, Newberg's work is very interesting. But the trouble is the interpretations people put on it. I think very often people interpret it how they want to. If they think there's a God spot, for example, they're saying, wow, this is a place where God, you know, God, meets your mind in this special spot, you know, when to me and to many other people, this is saying, oh, how interesting, when you have these experiences, these parts of the brain are involved. And it's very difficult to argue then when people are so sure that it's telling them something different. We get exactly the same thing in topics that I'm more familiar with, more directly familiar with, and have done a lot of research on, that is out of the body experiences and near death experiences, where we know, for example, that there is a spot in the right temporoparietal junction where it has been possible to stimulate it with electrodes right on the brain and produce and control out of body experiences in, out, amazing, you know. Now, why? You know, it's not because that's the place where the astral body kind of goes out of the brain, or where it connects from the, you know, the universe beyond or heaven or something at all. The reason that out-of-body experiences are generated when there's a lot of stimulation in that area, which can come from inside, of course, in different states of consciousness, is because that's a central part of the systems in the brain that construct what I would call an illusion of self. So one of the wonderful things we're learning in philosophy and neuroscience of self is how we build up a sense that inside here is me, and I'm looking out through my eyes at the physical world. This can't be true. There's no place in the brain for a conscious me. And what we do know more and more now is that this is all a story, a model, a representation, a self-model is the best term for it, really. And an important part of that self-model is the body schema. So the body schema is a kind of full map of your body. So at the moment, my body schema is being constantly updated as I'm moving my arms around and whatever I want to do. If there weren't a very, very quickly updated body schema, I wouldn't be able to do those things or speak, indeed. Now, the body schema, it's that important. If it gets disrupted, things go a bit weird. And this is what's happening in and out of the body experience. The body schema is disrupted, whether that's by an electrode or whether it's by sleep deprivation, which it was in my case, or certain drugs, or deep concentration, all sorts of things can disrupt the body schema. And the out-of-body experience is the brain kind of trying to get back. It's going, yeah, I know I've got arms and legs, but where are they? Can't anymore connect with the senses that would be telling you you're sitting at your desk and your arms are there. Instead, it's got this free floating thing constantly trying to come back, which is why it's very difficult to have out of body experiences if you want them. It's possible, but it's really not easy. And why, if you spontaneously have an out of body experience, the brain's constantly trying to get its body schema back to normal. And so the experiences tend to be very short. Unless you have a lot of practice, or as in my case, are so completely far out that you don't come back for some hours. Now, I can't even remember what the question was now, whether I was waxing lyrical on.
No, this is great information. I'm sure this is the kind of stuff that our viewers enjoy. So I was just sent about a week ago by a Christian friend an article about an atheist who'd had a near-death experience and had like this mystical, you know, otherworldly experience and, you know, changed her life. And I replied, said, you know, there's scientific explanation for this. Like, you know, there's the brain is being deprived of oxygen. There's the buildup of carbon dioxide. There's the norepinephrine. There's a biochemical signature to all this. And she's like, but, you know, you can't prove that it's the science and it's not that, you know, it was true. And I'm like, of course I can't. But, and it goes to the point you mentioned that people read into the research what they want to read into it. So,
yeah, so. That's absolutely right. And I've quite often met stories of that kind. And it's very hard because very often such people, I met one on a boat going somewhere, and he was so happy that he'd had this experience and that it confirmed his belief in God. And, you know, and I had this difficult, you know, do I try and dissuade him and give him some information, or do I just go, well, I'm very glad you're so happy? In that case, I did the latter, because this was just somebody I met kind of in passing on a boat. But then in other circumstances, I would try kind of softly and carefully to try to help people, if they want to think about how this can help you in your life to live better, how an experience like that can make, very often one key thing is feeling unity with the rest of the universe, because the relationship, this illusion that I'm in here and that the rest of the universe is out there, is kind of torn apart in such experiences. Now that can help people to feel more one with, you know, I'm looking out at these trees swaying in the wind at the moment, to feel more part of the universe, more related to nature and so on, can be a very positive thing. And that can be part of those experiences. And I try and shift things in that way so that the happiness might come not from, oh, now I believe, you know, whichever God it is they want to believe in, but can come from something more fundamental, one's relationship to everything else in one's life.
In my research into consciousness, or into history, so like Aristotle postulated that there was a universal consciousness. Some people today are speculating the same thing. So what are your thoughts on that? Is it like that you mentioned the term illusion? I believe I saw it on your website as well, that, you know, this is all, and this to me comes back a little bit to the Hindu mythology on Maya and the illusion that life is. Are you sort of in line of thinking that there is like this shared universal consciousness, or consciousness is something unique to each individual?
Well, first of all, I would say, I forgot my first part of your question. Sorry, I got confused. Can you remind me?
Your research and your findings into consciousness, are you leaning towards this universal shared consciousness?
Oh, yes, I remember part of this illusion? You were talking about illusion, weren't you? That's what yeah. I want to say. We have to be very careful with the word illusion, because when I say consciousness, I will say consciousness is an illusion. The self, as people normally experience it, as an illusion. Free will is an illusion. And I don't mean these things don't exist. I mean, then you're just kind of, you can't do anything if you say that. There's a real problem about consciousness, about what we mean. There's a real problem about the nature of self. Who am I? What am I? As one finds in meditation straight away. So I define an illusion the way the dictionary does. An illusion is not something that doesn't exist. An illusion is something that it's not what it seems to be. So to the extent that you believe that there's some kind of stuff called consciousness, which an awful lot of neuroscientists implicitly do, talking about the brain is conscious and certain parts of the brain give rise to consciousness. They're kind of treating it as some separate thing. And oh, the power of consciousness is another, you know, giveaway to people in an illusion, because at least from my perspective, consciousness doesn't have any powers. It's not this kind of thing we've got that does, or power or force or something that does anything. But what, so we, that's what I mean by illusion, and we have to be careful about that. The value of saying it's an illusion is to say, look, our ordinary intuitions about this self who lives in here and wields its consciousness and is separate from all the rest of the world is false. Let's try and rethink these things. Now, when we try to rethink them, there are lots of ways to go. And as you have pointed out, one of those ways is panpsychism. Everything is conscious. There are very many different versions of this. I have had the most awful, excruciating exchanges with Deepak Chopra, who is just utterly
I can imagine.
Yeah, I've got online the most awful one from last year where he just kind of steamrolled me, and I, you know, afterwards I was like, why didn't I stand up to him? Because he just goes on and on, kind of waffling and changing the subject every half a sentence goes to a different subject, and he'll just keep saying, but it's all consciousness, but it doesn't mean anything. I mean, nothing that he says, and there are others like him as well, allows you to predict anything or do any experiments or, you know, anything like that. There are various more well thought out forms of panpsychism, which are not like his, just everything's consciousness, end of story, but some which would say that every atom has a kind of minimal consciousness, or is a minimal consciousness. And then you've got the combination problem. Well, how do they come together to make a brain? And what's the relationship between the brain and experiences anyway? I find myself thinking about this a lot and not really getting anywhere, not really. I don't have a theory of my own. I think if I've got anything to offer the science of consciousness, it is to tear down a lot of the bad theories, rather like Dan Dennett did back in 1991 in his brilliant book, Consciousness Explained, which a lot of people hate that book. But he just picks apart the illusions that we have about ourselves and our own minds and shows how we can think differently. And that's really what I like to do when I'm thinking about consciousness.
Well, so, I would assume the science has evolved a little bit. It's been 30 years since Dennett's book came out. There's some new insights that have come out in the last 30 years.
There certainly are. But the traps that people fall into that he talks about have not gone away. So he talks about Cartesian materialism, which is the idea that lots of scientists will say, I'm a materialist, but they still believe in somewhere in the brain where it all comes together and consciousness happens. A kind of finishing line where brain processing, which is unconscious processing, becomes conscious. Now, a huge part of his work back then was to show why this isn't so. And we have a lot more research now that shows it's not so. And yet, you go on, if you read a lot of these neuroscience books, and there's loads of them coming out all over the place, I write CM, Cartesian Materialism. Descartes didn't say this, but it's kind of like what Descartes' dualism is kind of related to it. And I'll mark things with that. And it's amazing how people still think that way, because that fits our intuitions, that somehow in here is a brain and it's producing these experiences. And that simply cannot be the case. So that's a lot of what I think about in trying to understand consciousness and try to tear apart some of the bad ideas, because we're not really getting anywhere. The neuroscience is fantastic. We're really learning so much. But and there are good theories of consciousness at the moment. There's global workspace theory, integrated information theory, attention schema theory, and others, and people are beginning to try and test them against each other. My own view is that none of these actually is going to work, although attention schema theory is pretty interesting. And then there's predictive processing, which has really taken off now, active inference, controlled hallucinations. I mean, this is an idea that's been around for a long time, and it's only really picked up now with the neuroscience we have, which is that life is a controlled hallucination. So all the time, our brain is trying to predict what's coming next, and that's what the experiences are, at least this is one interpretation, that's what the experiences are. It's controlled by the input. So if we're asleep and dreaming, we don't have any input, which is why dreams are so kind of bizarre, because it's like our expectations, the brain's just producing stuff from what it already knows. But when we're out here in the world, I'm looking at you on the screen here, I can look out the window and at my desk, that is controlling the hallucinations that the brain is producing. This is you know, wonderful progress on understanding that, both mathematically and experimentally. Yes, but that doesn't stop people falling into the same traps of imagining a powerful self and the power of consciousness, and the brains are conscious, but is a brain conscious, or is a person conscious, or is the representation of a self in there conscious? People don't tend to ask that question, and that's the question that really interests me.
Interesting. Have you done any research into consciousness in animals? I know I've read some articles like the elephants and pigs and certain other animals display consciousness. So have you done any research into that?
What's it mean to display consciousness?
Don't know. I couldn't.
Well, I'm asking you a question. What would it mean? I've got a great big furry cat somewhere around here. Now, is he conscious? What would it mean for him to display consciousness?
I guess some sort of self-awareness of their surroundings and how they're interacting with it.
Okay, well, he's clearly interacting, and he'll come along and ask for his food, and he'll hop when I tell him to, or he doesn't get his food. he is clearly aware of his surroundings. He can go out and catch mice, you know, all of that. But you see, oh, well, maybe he's just a machine and he's just doing without any consciousness. And again, that's falling into a trap, which people fall into, thinking that all this could be done by a machine that wasn't conscious. So what extra does consciousness add? This is the famous zombie problem. Have you heard about that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so it's a philosophical problem. The modern version was really best written about by Dave Chalmers. And he says, you know, imagine there's two, well, I'll do it myself. Imagine there's two of me. If you were clever, you could put them on the screen, couldn't you? Okay, there's another one here. And one of them is conscious, and the other one is talking in exactly the same way and capable of doing all the same things, but it's all dark inside and there's no consciousness. Now, if they are identical in the way they speak, the way they move and everything else, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Evolution wouldn't be able to tell the difference. They are identical in every respect, but one is conscious and one isn't. Now, if you believe in the possibility of zombies, that's the philosophical zombie, then you can't find out anything about consciousness, because you couldn't tell. That's kind of the position we're in. But there are all sorts of philosophical arguments and very good arguments why that's just another one of these traps. If you believe in the possibility of zombies, then you're trapped, you can't get anywhere. So really you're asking me, when you say, does my cat display consciousness? You're asking for something that could discriminate between a machine that's doing things without consciousness or doing it with. I mean, my own way of thinking about this is any machine, a cat or a human or a fly or any of these things that can behave in the way we do and have all the responses to the world that we do would necessarily think it was conscious and have the illusions of consciousness. So because we are the kind of creature we are, we imagine there's a self inside and a world out there and all of that, that we get trapped into thinking that we have this extra thing called consciousness, rather than thinking these are the illusions that come about in this kind of a machine. Now, you mentioned self-awareness. Well, cats, as far as most tests are done, don't show any signs of self-awareness. And there's the classic looking in a mirror. What do different animals make of looking in a mirror? Because if I look in a mirror, or you look in the mirror, you go, oh, that's me. And that's me. My hair needs a bit of adjusting, or, you know, whatever it might be. So experiments have been done with loads of animals. Some of the other great apes, chimpanzees can show some signs of recognizing themselves in a mirror, but there's all sorts of arguments about whether they really do or whether they're just recognizing correlations between the movements in one or the other. Cats definitely don't. I remember when I got a previous cat, and he was a little kitten, And he went up to this, and this is a lot of animals will do this. He went up to this mirror and he's looking at it like, and kind of, and then he went around the back and looked to see if there's another cat behind, and then came back again, and then got bored and went off. Darwin, way back in the 19th century, did the first experiment like that. Wasn't exactly experiment, but he went to study to orangutans in the zoo and showed them a mirror. And they were more intelligent, or let's say more capable than my cat, but they did a very similar thing. They looked worried about it, went round the back, came back, and then started grooming themselves, like, ah, they know it's me. I'm that, you know, orangutan could say, well, that. So that sort of thing led to the famous red spot. So you anesthetize an animal or somehow get a red spot on its head or somewhere without it realizing it. And then if it looks in the mirror, if you had that done to you and you suddenly looked in the mirror and there's a red spot, you'd go, yeah, exactly. So if an animal does that, that's some sign of self-recognition. But there's endless arguments about what it really means. So I'm sorry, we can't say that any animal displays consciousness other than they're awake and aware and able to run around in their environment and do clever things. Right. It's a really deep problem.
Yeah. So this point, I've done a very, very little study into consciousness. I'm more of a historian. So consciousness is, as you said, there's these biological processes and we think it's the self that is conscious, but it's just basically the byproduct of what the brain naturally does, if I understand.
Yes, and usefully does. It's useful to us to have that view in getting around in the world. That doesn't mean that it's true. And this is a very important evolutionary point. You know, we didn't evolve to have a true view of the world. We evolved to have one that would keep us alive and having offspring. But hey, I thought we were, you know, I thought you wanted to hear about atheism and God and stuff.
This is part of it, right? Like this whole idea of consciousness is, you know, when my studies of Aristotle and his concept I mentioned earlier, that Aristotle postulated there was universal consciousness. So when Aristotle was rediscovered in the 1200s and it was coming to all the universities, and the big uproar of Aristotle was, if there's a universal consciousness, this was a threat to Christianity and Catholicism, because obviously then there can't be an individual soul that can be eternally punished. And so that was one of the objections the church had to teaching Aristotle. So there, I mean, what you're doing, these research into consciousness, it's all interrelated into atheism and skepticism and secularism. So you're with the Humanist UK, so you're a patron. So what does being a patron
Forgive me, I don't really know. I was invited a long time ago. I mean, in terms of what I do as a patron, they quite often ask for, can you contribute to, you know, give an answer to this question, we're going to use it in this context, or would you do a little video that can go on our website? Or then they ask all their patrons to do this kind of thing. It doesn't mean that I, you know, pay them loads of money, or I don't know what else it might expect to be. I think humanism, in the very broadest sense, I'm definitely humanist. You know, I'm an atheist. I believe more in humanity and us trying to solve our problems rather than deferring to some God who's not going to. And for us as human beings to take responsibility for the terrible mess we're making of our lives and our planet. That's really my main connection with humanism. Humanism is, you know, it doesn't have a Bible, so you don't have to sign up to anything in particular, other than probably being at least agnostic and probably atheist, to live without relying on a religion. And I guess that's why I would call myself a humanist. But then some people come along and say, well, you're not really a humanist because,
Well, I mean, I would assume, based on my own evidence, whether that's, you know, a logical fallacy of, you know, arguments from ignorance, the atheists that I know tend to be humanists, because one, like as Dawkins and others, you know, it's kind of absurd to define yourself as something that you're not. You know, I do not believe in a God, but, you know, the majority of atheists I would probably assume the mantle of a humanist, that, you know, we believe in equal rights, we believe in, you know, that everybody should be treated fairly and have no discrimination, whether it's a cultural bias or a traditional bias and or a religious bias, you know, against women's rights or gay rights, that sort of thing. So, and yeah, Steven Pinker argues, So Steven Pinker even argues in Enlightenment Now that when societies need to converge, it's towards humanism. So,
yeah, you mentioned human rights. I've been in some of the things I'm trying to write about religions as memes, especially the monotheistic religions, this keeps coming up to me that God hates human rights. When you read in the Quran and the Bible, which I keep reading bits of, I have to admit, I've read the whole Quran, but I have to admit I have not read the whole Bible. It's huge, isn't it? And it goes on and on. But in there are instructions that are against human rights. And so I'm very often asking myself, well, I think human rights are better than what gods produce. And we should live according to human rights, not gods, you know. But then, like, you get into deep problems about the nature of morality and whether there's any ultimate ethical grounding to any of this. But I was quite struck by that thought when I first had it, how much against human rights God is. And of course now we see, particularly with the Taliban and all kinds of versions of extreme Islam, that going against human rights is all part of it. And to my mind, what I'm finding very interesting is that these religions really evolved to be very helpful to the human genes. In the beginning, these religions would probably have kept people together in groups that would protect themselves, protect each other, and thrive better and actually survive. So genes and memes were going along together. But as time has gone by and we've become more knowledgeable, scientific, curious, and so on, that is changing. And the religions now, with the exception of the very extreme Orthodox versions, are diverging away from that and towards the what we call human rights of equality and freedom and so on. And the Orthodox ones that keep hang on this, making memes tied to genes, like Orthodox Judaism, where women are so tightly controlled, well, Islam absolutely as well, so tightly controlled, well, that's a value to the men, and it's a value to the men's genes. It's called mate guarding in biology. You know, you keep your mate, your female mate, under control, make sure she can't have sex with anybody else, only has it with you, and passes on your genes and passes on your memes, your religion, to those children. So that still exists in all the extreme versions of the monotheistic religions, but it doesn't any longer in all the other versions. So the Church of England, which is in many ways terribly nice, really does try to respect human rights while also relying on the Bible. And this is jolly difficult. I had the most wonderful thing recently. I was asked to do a BBC Radio 4 program on the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. And it was so interesting. And then he enjoyed it, so he invited me and my husband to dinner at Lambeth Palace, which was even more interesting. And he's so nice. I mean, I disagree with almost everything that he believes in, and yet his kindness and thoughtfulness just shines through. I can see why they made him the Archbishop. And I find this deeply difficult, because Christianity is supposed to be, certainly the New Testament and the way Jesus taught, about kindness and compassion and equally treating, you know, the prostitutes and the people who are usually shunned and so on. And yet the Bible hasn't changed for 2,000 years and is saying the opposite. So it's very interesting to see religions like this kind of collapsing. The Church of England going in this nice direction doesn't have the power to frighten you so much anymore. To stick with one of these religions really determinedly, you have to at least to some extent believe in heaven and hell and the punishment and the rewards that come later. It's difficult. I know a dear friend of mine who's a vicar, retired now, but she didn't believe in the virgin birth or the actual ascension into heaven, and you know, these are all kind of metaphorical. And but you can't keep a religion. Those religions have to thrive on threats and promises. This is how the meme plexes work: threats and promises to make you keep believing these things, and so on. And once you start to dismantle those core beliefs, it doesn't have the same power to trap people and cause them to stick with these false beliefs.
And there's also the religious red herring that they claim that, you know, religion is what gives us our morals, but ignoring the fact that there's so many immoral bits in their sacred scripture, and ignoring the fact that many of our morals preceded their codification in these scriptures. So, which brings me right back to how I came across you. And back in 2017, Dr. Jordan Peterson, another fellow psychologist, did a 15-part series, a biblical series, giving like a psychological interpretation to the stories in the Bible. And then you were on a Christian radio program called Unbelievable, debating Jordan with the moderator for Unbelievable. That's where I came across you debating him. And Peterson makes the same argument that, you know, he doesn't seem to catch his contradiction, that he's being quite the sky is falling, you know, Chicken Little, that, you know, he's warning about the decline, that the throwing away the baby with the bathwater, as he says, of ejecting Judeo-Christian ethic, which is the foundation of the Western ethic, is somehow going to create this nihilistic oblivion for everybody. But in his same series, he talks about how all these morals like blast into your consciousness thousands and thousands of years ago. I'm like, okay, so all the religions did was pick up the morals and codify it and pass it on. So in that sense, it was mimetic, but it didn't produce those morals. And I was quite intrigued. You made several good points in the Unbelievable. And I'll put the link in the description for our viewers if they want to watch this discussion.
Yeah, it was kind of fun and kind of not. They might enjoy it.
You came back to it at one point. You asked him to describe, like, what, you know, does he believe miracles exist? And everybody who's watched Jordan Peterson knows he's famous for his word salad. And you even used the word, like, you'd asked him before, you said you slithered away for it, and I want to bring you back to it. And he said, does he believe in miracles? And he says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. That's a miracle. I'm like, well, no, that doesn't answer the question. And you didn't press him on it.
Here's some water and here's some wine. No, it was very, difficult to press him. Not as difficult as Deepak Chopra, who just slithers away. It's very, I mean, odd comparison to make perhaps, but two people I've had real trouble with when I've been asked to debate with them. Jordan Peterson is extremely clever and very well read and very devious in his arguments in a completely different way from Deepak Chopra. So it was interesting that occasion when I went up to the recording studio in London, and they wanted to take pictures of us beforehand. And so we went outside and were standing against this wall, and they were doing pictures, and we got chatting about the paranormal. And he knew quite a lot about the research and so on. And we got into a really good, you know, really enjoyable intellectual discussion about that. So that was very helpful, because I upped my game, because I realized that he was very sharp and that I was going to have to be sharp back. But then when it came to the actual interview, I mean, he just kept diverting off, and the weirdest things he said and the incompatibilities of a lot of the things he said. I mean, the one that I remember, though I can't remember it clearly at all, but the conflict between him knowing a lot about evolutionary psychology and evolution in general, which to my mind is the most important thing for anybody to understand about how we got here and how the world works, and therefore the understanding about how this species got big brains, and that's why giving birth is much more painful for humans than it is for nearly every other animal. They just, you know, I've had a cat just slithered out four kittens while purring happily, you know, it's very different for humans. And yet, talking about how God, you know, wanted to punish women, or he didn't quite put it that way, but, you know, that it's something to do with what God ordained, that childbirth should be painful. Bizarre kind of contradictions in what he's saying. Yeah. I think he does. I notice he does do that.
The other thing that he always resists being pinned down on what he actually believes, but it's yeah. obvious that, you know, he's trying to preach some sort of, you know, Sam Harris called it God smuggling in his talks with him. And Peterson, to his credit, actually admitted he's God smuggling, like smuggling God into the conversation.
Yeah.
And to his credit, Peterson admitted that, you know, yeah, he does do that. One of the points, like you called him out as well, he's famous for citing Dostoevsky as, you know, what happens when people give up their belief in God. And you rightly so pointed out that this is a fictional character, that, you know, this is not, just because somebody stops believing in God doesn't mean they're going to be a sociopath or a psychopath and murder people. And this is where I find he's very disingenuous in his definition of an atheist, because he would claim that we are not atheists, that we because we believe in the inherent sanctity of other people.
Yeah, he kept telling me that I wasn't an atheist. And I'm going, how do I respond to that? As far as I can tell, I'm an atheist. I have many,
he's defined it in his own terms that an atheist is somebody who has given up that the other person has no intrinsic value and therefore we can do whatever we want. Again, this is an argument from ignorance on my part, but I don't think most atheists are making that claim, that you have no intrinsic value, therefore I can do what I want. It's simply, we don't believe in the supernatural. So he's very cagey in the way he does that. And as a psychologist, I posited in my series of videos that I've done, which I believe I sent one to you to watch, which I don't think has been released yet. But as a psychologist, it's like, why is he so cagey? Like, what, he seems to want to be this shill for Christianity, yet he refuses to define things properly. He slithers away from being pinned down on like things like, do you believe in miracles and what is God and this and that. One of the things that occurred to me, and I did the research and found out, he was talking about like the spark of the divine within. I'm like, that's a very Gnostic understanding. And yet this is exactly what Jung preached. And he was very much, he's preaching Jungian Gnosticism, yet Peterson and never anywhere in the Bible series does he openly admit to his audience what he's doing. And I think psychologically that's very interesting, you know, like physician, heal thyself. Like, you know, Jordan, can you not diagnose your own, you know, what you're doing and like how disingenuous you're being with your audience?
Well, he did end up in psychological trouble, didn't he? I mean, he had to go into rehab and spend a lot of time sorting his head out. I don't know what's happened to him recently. This is a long time ago, this interview with him. But that is a very common misconception. I mean, you've said a lot there about morality and where morals come from and so on. And I get this, it pops up a lot, the idea that if you give up believing in God, and a lot of Muslims that are up onto this as well, you know, if you don't believe in God and you don't follow the rules, then you are a bad person. This is part of the memeplex, making what makes you a good person is believing these things and obeying these rules, rather than what makes you a good person, and we're back to human rights here, is being kind, being fair, helping other people, doing something useful with your life, you know, those sorts of things. And there's plenty of evidence that atheists are, things like comparing atheists with control groups, they're just as likely to, you know, give money to charity, work for charities, help their neighbor, I mean, all sorts of things. As you say, this predated, well the morals have changed a lot, actually. I think I'd take issue with you on whether the morals that we have now were around a long time before the Bible codified them, because that's what they codified was much more gene-based, much more controlling, and much more racist, you know. I mean,
for sure.
The Quran says kill Jews, actually kill them, and of course kill atheists. I mean, atheists don't deserve to live and so on. So this is not quite, not my idea of being moral. but this is a problem for atheism in general to be accepted as a good way to live, because we don't go around saying, oh, atheists are good and religious people are bad, because that would be kind of against being fair to people and allowing them to have the beliefs they want and so on. So you're kind of a bit stymied. But
Yeah.
Hey.
It also ignores like the evidence, like in Europe, like the most secular societies are also like some of the safest and happiest versus like these intolerant Islamic states, you know, the people there, you know, and it's also showing that, you know, these are safe societies. So it negates their argument that if you stop believing, then suddenly you're going to have this anarchy and this nihilistic oblivion that Peterson is hyping. So,
yeah.
And in one of my videos that will be coming up with Peterson, he had Steven Pinker on his podcast. And in Peterson's own words, says, I've done the studies and on measure after measure after measure, you know, society's getting better, which is what Pinker pointed out in a lot of his works. And so Peterson's contradicting himself, what he's saying with Pinker on his own podcast versus what he's telling his audience in his biblical series, which again comes back to his disingenuousness. He's giving one story to one audience, and, you know, when he's with people like Pinker, who he knows he can't bullshit, you know, he's giving another. So.
Well, that was an interesting experience, and this has been an interesting experience, but I think I'm going to have to draw it to a close now. My energy is somewhat limited by years of chronic fatigue, so I have to be a bit careful to not do too much. So very interesting to talk to you, unless there's any last desperate thing you'd like to ask.
No, we were talking about keeping it to 45 minutes, so we got through everything. So I'd really like to thank you for coming on. I appreciate your time and your insights into consciousness. It was a fascinating discussion for me, and I hope our viewers really enjoy it too. So
I hope so too, and very nice to meet you. Thanks for inviting me on.
You're very welcome. Okay, so we'd like to remind everybody to please like and subscribe, and please do check out the links to Dr. Blackmore's podcast she was on, the Unbelievable podcast with Jordan Peterson, if you're interested in it, and it'll be a link to her webpage as well, where you can find her books. So we'd like to thank her once again for coming on, and we'll see everybody on the next show. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks for listening, and don't forget we're on YouTube, so follow us on YouTube. Just search for Atheist Alliance International, and please subscribe and hit that notification bell. We're also on all of your favourite podcast platforms, so make sure that you follow us on there as well. See you next time.